Andy has prevailed on me not to read his bio. He said, you can read it, it's there. And so suffice to say, Andy Pittman is a professor in climate science at the University of New South Wales. And will I hand over to you? That'll do nicely. All right.
That's all I need.
Thanks, Andy.
Thank you. Awesome. Which way are you going?
I'll go out this way.
Oh, yeah, you can't get out. How do I get rid of... Am I going the wrong way? I'm trying to get rid of John's talk. Right, I'm going to give you a quick rundown on what climate models can tell us about climate risk, because you've heard a little bit about climate models, and I'm going to give you a quick entry to what they actually are, without the math. So, I'm trying to work out which screen to look at. I'm going to give you a quick rundown on what models there are, and a quick rundown on do they work, and then what's coming down the pipeline. So first of all, there's two basic kinds of physical model. There's global climate models, which underpin the sorts of things that John talked about, and there's regional climate models, which have some strengths and some weaknesses, and I'm going to touch upon some of those things. But in the interest of time, I'll just quick rundown on what global climate models are, because they are not like the kinds of models commonly used in your field. They have the advantage that there are laws of physics that are kind of immutable. Things like conservation of mass and conservation of energy and Newton's laws of motion. The climate models we use and the sorts of climate models that underpin the work that John talked about are built from the fundamental laws of physics, which is handy because we don't think the laws of physics are going to change as the planet warms. Climate models are really cool. They're a little bit like, for those of you old enough, if you ever saw the episode of Star Trek where Spock played three-dimensional chess, climate models are a little bit like that. So I need you to imagine wrapping a chessboard around the Earth with multiple layers of a chessboard going from the bottom of the ocean to the top of the atmosphere. And in each of the resulting squares, we calculate temperature, the amount of radiation, the amount of moisture in the atmosphere, the amount of soil moisture, everything you could imagine. And we do that using differential equations that are time-stepped for however long you want your simulation to go for. And sometimes you run climate models for a few years, sometimes you run them for hundreds of years, and it's all in the same basic principle. As a consequence of those, you can do some really cool things now. You can simulate global cloud fields with considerable skill. You can simulate the detail of the eddies flowing in the ocean and how those exchange energy, salinity, mass. And there are experts in the room who work on those sorts of problems. But they have a fundamental problem. The best resolution used in global climate projections, those are the projections you're interested in, what the climate's going to be like in 2050 or 2100, are run at about 100 by 100 kilometers. So each of those little pixels, each of those pieces of the chessboard, are about 100 by 100 kilometers. So for one place in that grid square, you get a temperature, a humidity, and everything else. One value representative of that 100 by 100 kilometers. That uses the most powerful supercomputers on the planet in order to do that. So these are computationally complex. There are about 2 to 3 million lines of computer code. And at the moment, to first order, very approximately, it will take about a year to do a full set of climate projections on a petascale supercomputer, of which there is one available to the research community in Australia. If we doubled the resolution and made our global climate models run at 50 kilometers by 50 kilometers, it would take about 10 times the length of time to do those simulations, which is 120 months, which is longer than any of you would be prepared to wait. So it's not that we're lazy, and we would love to run at much, much higher resolution, but until the supercomputers become at least an order of magnitude faster, which actually now exists elsewhere in the world, we're a little bit limited on what we can do. And because 100 by 100 kilometers, a single data point in that area may not be exactly what you need, we have to find a way to get from that coarse resolution to spatial detail, which is more useful to you. And there are two ways of doing that. One is called regional climate modeling, or regional downscaling, and the other is statistical downscaling. And I'm going to show my bias now by dismissing statistical downscaling, which will cause some people in the room heart failure, because the way I am seeing climate changing, the way that extremes are emerging much, much faster than the climate models projected, because of how they're interwoven with changes in the weather, I don't think statistical downscaling, which is basically a regression based upon previously observed data, are going to give you good advice on how those things are going to change in the future. So, global climate models are defined by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change as robust tools at continental scales and above. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change does not say climate models are robust tools for simulating the future climate of Sydney. They say robust tools at continental scales and above. They're actually, I think, robust tools at finer spatial scales than that, but not to the scale of, say, Sydney. The data that underpin all of the assessments to do with global climate modelling are currently available at National Computational Infrastructure, NCI, in Canberra, but I don't think they'll be very useful to you. But there are products that John talked about in detail, which very likely will be useful to you. And as he described, as you bore down into the detail of those sorts of products, you need to know what you're doing more and more. But it's provided you're prepared to put that skin in the game and understand what those data are telling you, they really are fit for some purposes and are very useful products. But if you want to get down to much more detail on how climate may change in the future, one of the approaches are what are called regional climate models or dynamical downscaling. These are limited domains, so not the whole planet, but in this top right example, Australasia. And within Australasia, you can nest more and more detailed models. So, for example, you can nest within a large domain running at maybe 100 by 100 kilometers or 50 by 50 kilometers, increasingly detailed sub-regions. So maybe the whole of Southeast Australia at 30 kilometers, maybe the larger Sydney Basin at 10 kilometers, and then over just Sydney 1 kilometer. And the technology to do that now is pretty easily available. Each of you could download the models that would enable you to do that, and if you've got a decent server, you could in principle run it, but you would almost certainly stuff it up because it's still pretty challenging to do that well. The really cool thing about this is you can get down to quite sophisticated detail. This panel, the orangey panel, is just a case study, but it's a case study of how temperature in Western Sydney would increase as a consequence of urban development. There's plans for building new suburbs in Western Sydney, and due to the urban heat island effect, that would probably warm those regions in addition to climate change. And we can get down to the level of detail that lets you do bespoke simulations of the impact of various ways of designing the suburbs in Western Sydney to look at how that might amplify heat extremes coincident with the global warming. The good thing about regional climate models, and I won't go into detail of this, is they do simulate the basic drivers of extreme conditions. So this is an example of blocking, where the atmosphere gets blocked over a region, and if you don't have blocking, you won't get sequential days of heat waves. You've got to block the atmosphere before you can get a heat wave to evolve, ripen, and intensify. So it's very important for your models to capture certain synoptic states well, because those are conducive to particular extreme events. And these regional models, because they run at the level of resolution to enable you to describe how the synoptic scales form, do a pretty good job in capturing key aspects of the climatology of these sorts of things. They also have much smaller biases than the global climate models because they're more suited or fit for purpose for simulating the region. So in this case, we have a climate model bias on the left and a regional climate model on the right. It's a bias in rainfall, and in short, on average, the bias in the regional climate models are significantly smaller than the biases in the global models. But they would be because you've designed your regional model to be more fit for purpose for the particular region you're modeling. So it's not some wonderful attribute of these models. It's because you've actually designed them to simulate the regions that you're interested in simulating. You can also do some really interesting work with these special case studies. This is one from a colleague of mine at UNSW who asked the question, how much of the extreme rainfall that occurred a few years ago in Queensland could be attributed to extreme warming in the ocean temperatures in the tropics? And they basically showed that the warmer sea surface temperatures led to more moisture and heavier rainfall over Queensland. It's not rocket science, but it is now possible to experience a particular event and go back down the line of causation to see whether you can attribute that specific event to, for example, extreme temperatures. And we saw some examples of that in Carl's talk. The bad news is these regional models are computationally very expensive. And until we get bigger supercomputers, there's a limit to what we can do about it. There is also the fundamental problem that because they're computationally expensive, whilst we can run the climate models for centuries, we tend to run the regional models for much, much less time, years to a decade or two generally, although there are exceptions to that. If you only run your regional model for 5 or 10 years, you don't sample what are called the modes of variability well. So you've all heard of El Nino and La Nina cycles, or ENSO. You could run your regional model for 5 years and never sample an El Nino. Or you could run it for 10 years and never sample the interactions between El Nino and the Indian Ocean Dipole. The details of this don't matter, but if you only run your models for a short period of time, you've got to be very careful how you do it, or you lull yourself either into a false sense of security, there's no problem with drought, it's always raining plenty in the future in Australia, and then you discover you never actually sampled the modes of variability that lead to drought in Australia. So it's actually very difficult to robustly design regional climate modeling experiments to be exactly fit for purpose for what you need. Regional climate models are, however, useful tools for examining continental scales and below. They need to be embedded in climate models if you're doing projections. So you've got to get the conditions outside your area of interest from somewhere for 2030 or 2050 or 2070. And the place you get that from is the global climate models. If the global climate models are doing all that large scale really, really well, and getting all of the things that lead to interesting weather and climate events over Australia really well, then I suspect the regional climate models would downscale that information with considerable skill. But there are whole research communities in the world looking at how well global climate models capture all those drivers, and some models do it quite well, and some models don't. So you've got to be very careful in how you pick which models to use around the regions of interest. As with the global climate models, there are synthesized products that now exist. There's the NARCLIM dataset, there's the Tasmanian Futures dataset, and I think we heard about a Victorian example coming as well. So these data also exist, but they are quite substantially large datasets. Some of them are multiple petabytes in formats that you may not be familiar with. So they're not necessarily easy to use the direct data. But in summary, just on that little bit, if you're trying to understand how climate would affect your personal interests and portfolios, I doubt that using direct global climate models would be very useful to you. They are, at continental scales and above, reliable tools. I think you need to find ways to add value to those data to get them down to the scales and describing the phenomenon that actually matter to your particular portfolios. The regional models are likely much more useful in that context, with a very major proviso that the boundary conditions around your area of interest have to be robustly simulated by the global model. That is why groups like CSIRO, who do this work routinely, are important, be even more important if they were funded properly to do it well, because they know about this stuff and they don't make the mistakes that groups would make if they were new to this area. But what about my favorite topic, climate risk? I'm more interested in things like Lismore flooding. My center director lives in Lismore and he can't come and see me when his town is flooded. I'm particularly interested in what would happen to the boat I don't own in a cyclone, or what would happen if the road I drive on liquefies. And it did in New Delhi, which is really cool. got that right. We're becoming really concerned now about what we're describing as compound events. This is a particular compound event. This occurred in 2010. There was simultaneously four heat waves across the Northern Hemisphere, 53.6 degrees in Russia. I have no idea what 53 degrees feels like, and I don't really plan to. Half a trillion in losses. It was associated with variability in the jet stream. In other words, these four heat waves were not independent. They were physically connected. So you want to understand risk associated with what amounts to genuine connections in the climate system. And that's something that we are really beginning to understand. There's another example for Australia, where work by Tess Parker demonstrated that heat wave and fire conditions over Victoria is physically connected with cyclone activity in the north. In other words, if you've priced risk of a cyclone and you've priced risk of heat waves and bushfires and assume them to be independent, that's not right. They are actually physically connected under some circumstances. We don't think you can do these sorts of connections well in most of the ways that the regional climate models have been used for downscaling. Because they're expensive computationally, we look at a limited region. And yet, we're now beginning to understand that what happens in that limited region directly connects with, in a physical way, phenomena that have been acting outside that regime that won't be captured at the coarse resolutions of the climate models. In other words, we have a real problem. We need to run the very sophisticated regional models over a region big enough to capture all of the key drivers and the connections that lead to these compound events. So what I'm trying to get here is it's a multifaceted problem to do accurate, robust risk assessment for future climate. You've got to get the large-scale trends right first. This is the temperature trend globally, and it changes the background behavior of the climate system. If you warm the planet by 2 degrees, some regions warm by 4 degrees and some regions might not warm by more than half a degree. You change the whole pattern of the background climate. And you've got to get that right, and climate models do that, I think, stunningly well. You've then got to translate that through the modes of variability. Do you get the right response of the El Nino and La Nina and the Indian Ocean Dipole and the Southern Annular Mode, all that stuff right? Do you get how that responds to the global average is right? And I suspect climate models are developing the skill to do that quite well. You then have to get how that all translates through synoptic scale and weather patterns. Extreme events are to do with the weather. There is no such thing as a globally average change in the probability of days over 40 Celsius. It doesn't make sense to ask that question. It is all about what happens where your business is, where your supply lines are, or in the case of liquefying bitumen, where you happen to be driving today. So you've got to get that connection right, connecting from the decadal and interannual variability right through the synoptic situation down to how local scale phenomena amplify in extreme. And a good example was Moree last summer, where it broke the record for days over 35, I think, by like doubling. That was not caused by vertical warming of the atmosphere by CO2. That was caused by a reorganization of the synoptic patterns, probably to do with an equator to pole temperature gradient, that changed the likelihood of the washing away of the heat wave by a southerly change and allowed the heat wave to ripen and ripen until it was just off the charts. You can't get that subtlety in our climate models, and you can't probably get that subtlety in our current regional models. So where does that leave us with climate risk? Well, it depends. Three examples: hail, drought, and heat waves. Well, in the case of hail, hail is a local scale phenomenon embedded in synoptic scales, and it occurs on meteorological timescales. You do not get 30 days in a row of hail at the moment, or ever. I suspect the sorts of downscaling that are being done with regional models are going to do that really well. They do the local scales, they do the synoptic scales, they do the time scales to do with the meteorology. I see no evidence that you've got to get the global mean warming patterns right to simulate how warming temperatures in the oceans might feed into changing risk of hail. So I think the regional models are probably pretty good at that. I suspect the regional models to get drought, however, are more of a problem. There are droughts that occur for centuries. The Millennium Drought in Australia lasted a decade. These were big deals. In order to get those things right, you need to get the large-scale patterns right and how those large-scale patterns translate into regional and local-scale phenomena. And for that, you've got to get that interaction of the global models and the regional models accurately. So I personally don't think we know what the change of the sign of drought will be in the future. And finally, in terms of heat waves, well, there's a good news story. The synoptic scales that lead to heat waves, I suspect the regional climate models do that really, really well, because they do get that blocking pattern right, and they would impose that blocking pattern on long-term trends really well. What I'm trying to get across here is, if you are aware of what your business is vulnerable to, some of those things I think we can assess future risk really well. Some of them we can't, but we need to know what you're vulnerable to before we can provide that information reliably. The good news is there is a future. I think we now know how to do this really well. I think it's going to require us to run our global climate models at very much higher resolution, probably around 20 kilometers, to get the synoptic scale situations really, really well, get the large scale trends really, really well. I think there are groups around the world who already do that. There are groups in the UK that are running global models at about 20 kilometers. We can't do it in Australia because we don't have our big enough computer systems, but hopefully we may do in the future. It is going to generate a mind-blowing amount of data. And one of the things it would be a really good idea to begin to think about in business is how you'd manage the data from those sorts of modeling techniques through into your own business, because it won't be how we've been doing it in the past. So to summarize, our global climate models, I think, are excellent at continental scales and above, and I doubt that that is what you really need. I think our regional models can be used to assess some climate risks with real fidelity and skill, but you need to engage with and talk to the people who run those models. Sometimes I actually think the best approach is expert judgment with scenario development, and the sorts of things that John talked about are ideal for that. The choice of tools and data require expert judgment, so you need to actually engage with people like John and Carl and others to find out what are the best tools for your particular purposes. And I think there's a way forward with next generation models that are going to solve a lot of these problems, but I wouldn't bank on you seeing those in the next 5 years. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Andy. So we've run over time a bit, so we've not got time for a formal Q&A now, but if we'll be able to, you can ask questions of speakers over lunch if you're able to stay around for lunch. And yes, so apologies for that. So just quickly, if I could ask Jenny to come up and close the seminar.
Thank you. And thank you to all our speakers. I thought actuarial models were complicated, but I think we're on a new level. Oh, I've heard about a new level. It's not an area I'm particularly personally all that familiar with, but it's been really interesting from my perspective. And I think it's wonderful to see that sharing, I guess, of ideas between different disciplines. So thank you to the Earth Systems and Climate Change Hub for partnering with us to put together this series. Much appreciated. And thank you to our organising committee of Tim Andrews, John Clark, Nick Wood, Pandora Hope, Richard Mateer, Andy Pittman, Jeff Gooley, David Hudson, Marcus Thatcher, Elaine Grace and Sarah Gibson. So I guess it's been a huge effort from lots of people. Thank you. And thanks to the events team and HQ. And please share your feedback so that we know what you're looking for in the future series. And let's have lunch and share some conversations. So thank you all.